Hello, and welcome back to A Life Economy, dedicated to exploring the intersection of technology, spirituality, and consciousness. We're your hosts, Cosmo Sharp.
And Summer Perry.
And today we are joined with a very special guest, Tom Wright. Welcome, Tom.
Hello.
Awesome. So, Tom, you are an expert on the circular economy, and that is one of the big themes that we're looking to explore today, as well as what it will take to move us towards a regenerative paradigm and some of the differences between where we are now and where we want to go as a society. You've been gracious enough to put together a wonderful slideshow presentation that we will walk people through. And if you're listening to the audio, just feel free to look into the show notes and you can watch the video to get a sense of exactly what it is that we're talking about. But before we dive into the slideshow, we would love to hear a little bit about your background and how you got into exploring the circular economy as an integral part of your life and career.
Yeah, it does start when almost sadly with John Kennedy's assassination. I'm in fifth grade at the time. I grew up in East Bay. I'm born in Oakland. I grew up in East Bay. And when Johnson became president, Lyndon Johnson became president, he created a thing called the Great Society. Or I shouldn't say he, because the Congress passed it and everything. So the United States had this thing called the Great Society. And amongst what they did was they put a lot more money into education. And of all sorts, if you look at the lesser achieving to the most achieving, they put money behind everybody, especially the both ends of the spectrum. And so I lucked out in that I got accelerated in math and science, but I had to go to special classes that were either at Berkeley High or UC Berkeley at the time, and we got tutored by graduate students in math and science. And it was once a week for, I think it was Thursday afternoons. And we took a little school bus and we went there. One afternoon we went to, and getting prepared for this summer, it asked where I was. And it was, I think it was a Berkeley High, but it was a small lecture hall. And I know it wasn't Wheeler, which is a big lecture hall at UC Berkeley. Because it was a small lecture hall, because I kind of remember the setting, and in walked this person, and he was obviously older, looked like a grandfather, but he was short and he was bald headed, and his name was R. Buckminster Fuller, and he gets introduced to us as his, there's 22 of us in this class, and he gets introduced to us, and the first thing, by the way, you should understand about Bucky is he's diminutive. He's maybe 5'3", 5'4", but he literally had a domed head and he looked like an egghead. I mean, I don't mean that to be funny. I mean that to just you go, oh, this guy must be smart. He's got an egghead. I mean, that's when you're in fifth grade. That's kind of how you think. You know, you think dumb things that way. And he has, he really believed in having models, what he called artifacts. And so the first thing he does to this class, and we're in this, like I say, it's a small, like, lecture hall, because it's, in other words, the second row is above the first row, the third row is above the second row type of thing. And so he throws out to the first row, he throws out two globes. One is a globe that people are often used to seeing, which is the nation state globe. And you can use five different colors to make distinct the nation states. And he throws out that globe of the earth, and he throws out another globe to the front row, and it's a bas relief globe. And what's that mean? That means that instead of showing nation states, it shows, you know, the Alps and the Himalayas and the Sierras and the Rockies, all in the Andes, all with, you know, white caps. It's white, and then the valleys are all green. And the oceans are blue, et cetera. So that's, and he says to us, right, this is like the first or second thing he ever says to us is which one of these is more real from outer space? And we knew exactly where he was going with this. he knew that he meant the bas-relief map, that in outer space, you don't see nation states. You don't, the only kind of borders you see are the borders of land versus water, you know, rivers and that, and oceans. And so he was trying to point us out to just think in terms of what's real and don't take everybody's opinion about what's real, except against this kind of reality, which is the Earth is whole and singular. And he called us Earthians. And so that always stuck in my mind, this idea that we're singular on the planet. We're singular in terms of our species. We're singular in terms of how the planet operates. He wrote a book, and it had to be 1968, 1969, because I read it in high school. It was called Operation Manual for Spaceship Earth. And it's a very esoteric birth, but he talks about regeneration and synergy in that book. And so I read that book, and so did people. Again, I went to high school with about five of us from that 22, went to the same high school. And we ended up building an electric car. When I got to college, we started a recycling center in the base of my college. And this all had to do with Bucky's thinking. It all had to do with Bucky talking about regeneration and synergy and thinking wholes rather than thinking parts. And anyway, obviously, it kind of changed the trajectory on what I was going to do in life, because it was hard to get rid of this thinking. Does that make sense to put it that way?
Yeah, sure.
Yes, it's very effective. It's very affecting and effective.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, oh, you know. So, you know, eventually, I got involved with organic agriculture, but I went to UC San Diego, a college there called Revell College, and I have a degree in economics. And so economics is something that I've always thought of, but I realized when I was in college, when I was learning traditional economics, that it was what we'll talk about this a little more when we bring up some of the pictograms, that it was a linear economics, that it was based on extraction. Mm-hmm. And that was true for both socialism and capitalist models in the 70s, by the way. To make it sound like socialism was somehow more enlightened ecologically is not true. It wasn't any more ecological than capitalism in the 70s. And we talked about it, and a book came out called Limits to Growth. It's a good book to read. Still came out in the early 70s. And again, it's basically you can't keep growing an economy based on stuff on a planet that is limited. There are limits to growth, perpetual material growth, of course, is what it's talking about. And that was a very good book to read. And it kept me thinking about there must be another path. And I went to work and everything. And then eventually more and more people started writing about it. It initially got called environmental economics. Then it got a nuance changed into ecological economics. And when I did my master's, that's what I was studying, was ecological economics.
So before we get into some of the other aspects of your career, I'm really curious to dive into this meeting or lecture from Buckminster Fuller. I mean, it's really cool that you were able to hear from him and meet him in person in what sounds like a pretty intimate setting. How old were you at the time, and what impact did he have on your life in that moment and going forward till where you are now?
Well, I was 11 years old, and like I said, there were some of us who ended up going to the same high school. He was famous for the thing called the geodesic dome. Mm-hmm. And we built a geodesic dome. We manufactured that at our high school. We put it in a parking lot. And then we put a hibachi with like 8 coals in it. And on a cold winter day, we kind of proved his point. You know, you went to the, it was made with, in fact, my dad supplied the plastic film. I know that sounds like a pretty bad thing to do nowadays, but we covered it with plastic film. And so it was like a teepee in a sense that we just had a draped door that you come into it.
Nice.
And you close the drape behind you. And all there was a little hibachi around this. Basically, it was about diameter was probably 12 feet of the geodesic floor, And we had a hibachi with eight coals in it, and it was warm in the geodesic. And that's what we were trying to prove, how energy efficient the shape was. So he had an effect that way. What I should say a couple of things about the first meeting. And I went to watch him speak probably at least another five or six times in my life. In fact, I think the last time was like 1978. So that was some 14 years after I first met him. So because he toured the country and gave lectures. That was kind of what he did. Mm-hmm. And what he was famous for, you know who the Grateful Dead is, of course. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what are the Grateful Dead famous for besides just their music? What besides pot too? I don't want to go that far. The Grateful Dead are famous for just playing, right? Mm-hmm. And they can play for 3 to 4 to 5 hours, right? You know, I mean, I once heard him as Santa Barbara play for 5 hours. Wow. Right? They just move the musicians around the stage, and guy goes takes a rest, and another one comes on. They just keep playing. Well, we used to joke that Bucky was a Grateful Dead of public speakers, he could just all he needed was a glass of water, and so this is before I ever knew the Grateful Dead. Their first meeting, of course, is before I ever knew about the Grateful Dead, but. But it was interesting. So we're in this afternoon class, which I think was scheduled to be an hour and a half. And at the end of the hour and a half, Bucky is still talking, of course. Because for Bucky, an hour and a half is nothing.
Right.
You know, he's got his glasses water, he's got his artifacts, he's got these admirers, these young admirers out in front of him. And he's just talking away and he's explaining his ideas and talking about this situation, that situation, and being Bucky-like. And you can, by the way, his grandson is the curator of his estate right now. And his grandson has kept a website up, and you can actually go look at some of Bucky's talks on the web for free. So it's still available for anybody to go listen. But this is this part of the story I want to get to. So the graduate student, the teacher to us, doesn't stop him at an hour and a half, okay, because he's still talking. So remember I said we came there by one of those little yellow buses, not a big yellow bus. Mm-hmm. And so the bus driver comes in the room and looks at the graduate student and says, "We're running late." And the graduate student kind of just doesn't say anything because Bucky's talking, right? And so then about 15, 20 minutes later, the same bus driver comes in going, "I'm going to lose my job." He literally vocalizes it.
Oh, no.
He vocalizes it. "I'm going to lose my job if we don't get going." You know, I can basically can only make so much excuse for traffic type of thing, you know.
Right.
And, it was funny, you know. And Bucky heard him, of course, and then stopped. But, if the bus driver hadn't come in, we'd have been sitting there today. I swear, that's how he was. You know,
that's really amazing that he was able to captivate an audience of children for that long. I mean,
we were in there because we were mathematically intuitive. That's the language they use to describe us.
Oh, cool.
And not my language. That's the language that's how they described us. Mm-hmm. So basically. You know, like two of those guys in my class ended up running nuclear power plants.
Wow.
So there's some pretty cool dudes in there. And it was dudes, unfortunately, no offense. There was only one girl out of 22. Mm-hmm. So that there was a sexist element to it, no doubt about it. So anyway, it was fascinating because he was Bucky. And that's the other thing. He was only, like I say, we're at that age, you're basically 5'3", 5', you're basically his height.
Mm-hmm. That's hilarious. So then, that's a really cool story.
They look like grandpa, you know, he still looked like grandpa, you know.
I love the example of the two globes that you mentioned in the beginning. And that's a really powerful physical metaphor, I suppose, for the way in which that, you know, we're interconnected, and to show us what is really important and the reality of how we artificially, you know, we create this illusion of separation, right? With this idea of different nation states and nationalities. But, you know, when you zoom out from the perspective that we are mostly limited to down on the ground out into outer space, and you look at the reality of Earth, you see how ultimately we are all part of this one system. And that is something that many astronauts have commented on as part of, you know, the well-known observer.
Yeah, it's called the overview.
Right, the overview. Right, thank you. Yeah. Observer effect is something different.
Yeah, it's called the overview effect, which is, right. Which is, you can imagine, it's like, oh my goodness, I'm from that little thing out here in the suspense of this. It's got to look like in the middle of nowhere, like a void. Doesn't it? You know, you got to imagine it's just an incredible feeling. Yeah. Well, Bucky invented a thing called the world game. Mm-hmm. And the world game, you could play it like on a high school basketball court. And basically it was to show the how, what resources existed and how they were allocated.
Hmm.
And in order to fit all the resources on the, again, it's an economics game in a sense. Because it was about resources. Bucky wouldn't have called it that, but it was. And I remember playing it. We played it in high school. And you know, the it's an enlightening thing to show when you're 5% of the world's population and you use 25% of the resources.
Right.
Wow.
When you can physically show that, and you know, you could, people would be in the stands, right? They could get in the stands. They could look down the basketball court, and we would reconfigure things according to, okay, this is how much the United States has of these resources, and then that it's strong visuals. Like you, that's what Bucky was very visual in the way he explained things, and is very, very enlightening. And I'm glad I made sense to you, and I'm glad it seems like you more than understand it. It's
yeah. Cool. So speaking of visuals, I think now would be a great time to jump into some of the slides that you've prepared, if you don't mind.
Sure. Bucky talked about making things obsolete a lot by so this is the quote. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
One of the easier examples would be a horse and buggy changed by an automobile that's electric or gasoline.
Sure.
So that would be an example of what he's trying to drive at. This is just one of many things that he said that you kind of had to think about, because I don't know about you, but as you see where the world's going and what the world's becoming or what it's not becoming, what you'd like it to become versus what it's not becoming of what you like, you would like to see things go obsolete, wouldn't you?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So you're wondering why. I mean, right now, as a culture, we're trying to figure out how racism could become obsolete, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that we're not going to discuss that, but as an example of something, don't you wish it was obsolete by now? I do.
Absolutely.
I grew up in Oakland, which is a very multi-ethnic experience. And it's hard for me to believe that we're, you know, basically in 1870 still in some ways, you know, but I kept thinking about what he meant. And then, because I got involved with organic agriculture and promoting organic agriculture and it going from, you know, basically Rodale type of thinking and a few other people, Alan Chadwick out of UC Santa Cruz, was considered very esoteric. Mm-hmm. And the more I got to learn about it, the more I realized, well, you know, it's one thing about making something obsolete just by creating something. In other words, creating viable organic agriculture. You had to become conscious that you were making the other thing obsolete, and you actually had to oppose it. You had to oppose it to a certain extent. You had to explain to other people why it should become obsolete. So I coined a phrase called conscious obsolescence, just to try to explain that phenomenon of your own mind going through the process of, well, it's still here, even though I have the better mousetrap. You know, I've got the better mousetrap, and not everybody wants it. And so it's it's just one of those ideas that I thought we should talk about, because when it came to circular economics, I knew that there had to be a better way to think about economics, like I suggested before. And I already knew that amongst my economics professors and TAs at college, some of them were thinking the same thing, like, we can't do this extractive economics forever. There's a limit to how much we can extract. And of course, as your generation knows, there's a limit to how much you can pollute.
Yeah,
absolutely.
My generation was just becoming aware of that. You should know that UC San Diego is Scripps is part of UC San Diego. And Scripps is where the study of the first measurements of carbon in the middle atmosphere started. And it's still to today, Scripps is where you can go to a graph on their website at Scripps and see the CO2 in the upper atmosphere being measured at Mauna Loa. So the fact that pollution was happening and we can measure it and we knew it was changing things, we understood that in the 70s. I just want to be clear with you, okay, that we understood there was a problem and that it wasn't going away and it was getting worse, if you will. And yet people were just living fine and driving more cars. In fact, getting bigger cars with more vroom to them, you know. So muscle cars was a phenomenon of the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. You guys ever heard that phrase?
Yes. Muscle cars? Yeah.
Oh, sure. You know about it? Okay, that's good. So anyway, this is why the idea of conscious obsolescence struck me so much, is that it's we do need to create the new reality and create the new model. That is the more important thing than fighting existing reality. But in marketing language, you have to reposition existing reality. You have to tell people why it's not working. You have to explain to people why it's not working. Otherwise, sometimes they just don't see it for whatever reason.
Absolutely. That's really cool, the term conscious obsolescence, because planned obsolescence is generally viewed as a negative thing, but conscious obsolescence sounds a lot more thought out and seems like people could be really receptive to a concept like that. Why do you think it is that we experience so much resistance in society when it comes to changing existing systems?
Gee, that you don't want to come up with a simple question, do you? it's people have paradigms, frame, and I use the word paradigm meaning a framework. People have their worldview, and we it's been studied by a lot of people. This, and people get stuck in their worldview. You know, for most of human existence, the species act as if the world were flat, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then even Ptolemy said, well, it's not flat, it's round, but it's the center, but the earth is the center of the universe and the sun goes around it. I mean, that was true until Copernicus. That's a little over 500 years ago. So, I mean, why did people... I mean, have you ever been to the top of a high mountain and looked over the horizon? It doesn't look flat, does it? It looks curvature. It's curved, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That was true in the 14th century too. So you're kind of asking a big question in the sense of how do people develop worldviews? I'm not sure, other than it's kind of like rote. It's kind of what they're used to, or you know, the king or the queen says so. So that's what you believe, or the church says so. So that's what you believe. And you know the story of Galileo at all?
Somewhat. Could you refresh your memories?
Yeah, but it's just that you know he was almost persecuted. He was almost killed.
Exactly.
For describing, here he was correct about describing the way the sun and the earth and the moon all work together, and they were going to hang him up and quartering, you know. So it is a little different. That why don't we just believe what the best thinking is? I don't know. We don't necessarily believe what the best thinking is. And I guess we need to maybe debate more about what the best thing, how to debate the best thinking maybe we need to get used to doing that somehow. You know,
yes.
Go ahead. Sorry.
That would be refreshing. I just picked up on two things that you spoke about just then. One being that sometimes having a worldview challenge could be received in a negative way or can be perceived as scary. And also, I thought about the day-to-day routine of getting through life and meeting our responsibilities. And I sometimes think that that's a big reason why change is not received as well as it could be. What are your thoughts on how people can sort of incorporate change into their own personal experience in their own day-to-day life that could possibly expand their consciousness on what might be possible for the future?
Well, another simple question. I do think the meditation helps. I mean, if you're asking for what I've found that might help, I do think you have to quiet your mind. I do think you have to be quiet. And then I do think there's a distinction between brain and mind that most people are aware of once they do get quiet. And your brain may be the organ that's in your cranium, but your mind is pretty universal. And that from that place, you're better off. But, you know, we have a rush, busy, go culture, at least until COVID hit, you know, that made it very hard for people to get quiet. It's pretty easy to see that societies that have chosen quiet and slow are less likely to be violent than cultures that haven't. It's pretty easy to see. I guess in some ways, the way you ask the question, it makes me go into and maybe it's because I'm conscious about what's going on in my own culture right now, that I think we need to be a little more quiet somehow. I don't know. Does that sort of answer what you're
absolutely asking? Yeah. Culture is so important. And I think Bucky was really clear on that too.
Yes, he was.
He is a self-proclaimed civil engineer or a social engineer, right?
Yep. No, that's what he said. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it's an interesting side effect of this whole corona crisis where, you know, there's certainly a lot of negative and scary, screwed up things that are happening. But at the same time, there's this great moment of pause and reflection where we all get to calm down and relax a little bit and have a significant change of pace from what we're used to, constantly running around, going, driving or taking public transportation back to the office, back and forth. And at least, you know, I can speak for myself, you know, having all this time home, you know, certainly presents new and different challenges, but at the same time, I'm grateful for the general sense of more ease, I would say. I mean, especially as it relates to, you know, traffic in Los Angeles. That's just like one specific example.
It's a great example. I mean, you've heard the trivia that when you take a picture of the LA metro area from a satellite, and then you overlay it over a picture of a cancer cell system, they look very similar.
No, wow. Whoa.
That's scary.
It is. It's because LA isn't organized for calm.
Wow. That is a powerful statement.
Oh, I'm seeing that. Yeah, I just got the visual. That's so true. That's very scary. Wow.
Can you imagine if they'd have cared about leaving trees? You know, there's a big movement in LA to plant trees, which it should. Mm-hmm. And it's just funny. It had trees at one time. You know,
wow.
So, you know, that's
fantastic. Do you know the name of the movement?
Oh God, I'm trying to remember his name. It's terrible. I'm like tree planters. Anyway, you have to excuse me. I don't remember.
Oh, no worries. No worries at all.
I really appreciate this.
I'm visualizing the founder of the movement in my head when I'm talking to you, and I can't remember. Tree people.
Treepeople.org. Yeah, I just found it. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love this quote, and it's one of my favorites from Bucky. It reminds me of something that Michael Tellinger talks about, he's well known for the Ubuntu contributionism movement, and his goal is to create a world without money. And regardless of whether you believe that is the goal or aspiration of where we should be heading as a society, I'm not totally sure myself, but he makes the point that in order to, you know, to create the world that we want, we cannot fight the existing systems. We have to create a new system that works in parallel alongside the existing one, that is so much obviously better than the current one, that we naturally fall into place with the new one, because being in resistance, being in fight in a mode of competition or fighting with the existing paradigms is not going to work.
No, it's true. No fight. Yeah. No, you just charge it. You just. I mean. There's a great quote from the first. You know what OPEC is, and so OPEC's. I want to say the first minister of OPEC. You know, OPEC's a group of petroleum producing countries, mm-hmm. and Sheikh Yamani was his name. And it sounds like Shake Your Money, right? But I think his name was Sheikh Yamani, and he said the Stone Age did not end for the lack of stones. And his simple point was that you may challenge us, but you know, we'll just lower the price. We'll make sure existing competitive models are disappear. By the way, that's mm-hmm. part of what Sheikh Yamani was expressing. And so I appreciate the idea of getting rid of money. And as an economist, I guess I'm sort of bought into the fact, not so much about money, but about accounting, that we have to keep track of flows and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, even when we're trading, if we're trading whatever we're trading, that we share and value trade, whether it's knowledge for comfort or knowledge for housing or knowledge for food or however we trade, is still an accounting methodology. So I always wonder about that myself. I you know, it's in the Bible, the money is the root of all evil, or gold's right. The root of all evil, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a strong statement, and I'm not sure it's perfectly true, but I do agree with what we're talking about in terms of, if you fight petroleum, what happened in the pandemic was what will happen again, and that doesn't necessarily rid us of the issue that we need to rid us of, which is carbon pollution in the atmosphere and oceans. And they'll just lower the price. They, up in Northern California, you got down below $2. I know if somebody's in the Midwest, they probably got down below $1.50.
Wow.
And maybe the true price should be, and this kind of relates back to why I'm a circular economist, is that one of the things that I realized about money and price points and all this kind of thinking was that every time people talked about market economics and talk about money and prices, if they were real, they were they're metaphysical, right? Mm. The concept of money is a metaphysical construct, mm-hmm. you know, and they're very good at making it up like that's the market, so it's real. Well, I'm sorry, the true cost is you gotta look at the true cost in a different way, because just because gas is $2 a gallon doesn't make it great. I think we'd be better off if gas was $10 a gallon. You know, this we'd be more likely to do something different, wouldn't we? Mm-hmm. So, anyway, the long ways of coming around to the point of about money, making money obsolete is a tough one. That we need a way to exchange so that we can account for value. How we do that?
Right.
That's an interesting thing. I mean, you know, that's why there's all these other currencies coming up now. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of alternative currencies, although I've never done any cryptocurrency exchange. Have you all done anything in those?
Experimented
a little bit, yeah.
With it, yeah. A little bit.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, let's move on to some of the other slides, because I know you have a bunch more in here.
Yes, we do.
So let's move on to this next one, the circular economy butterflies. So again, for people that are just listening to the audio, it'd be great if you could kind of talk out loud, you know, what we're seeing and how everything is working here.
Yeah, this is from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, which has become sort of the grounding for the construct that everybody calls the circular economy. And it's often called the butterfly because it has two different wings. The wing, as you're looking at it at the left-hand side, the green side is the circular economy of biological nutrients. This is the economy that is been the economy until the Industrial Revolution. This was human economy. It was based on biological nutrients. It was based on the sun. The sun grows plants and plants create food and the humans live off of food and the animals eat the food and the humans eat the animals. And, you know, that's the biological economy, you know, and that's how humans and nature relates. When humans started learning how to create glass and metals and stuff, you know, the last 1500 years, 2000 years, 2500 years, then we started developing materials that are not biological. They're technical is the language that is used in this nomenclature. Mm-hmm. And those aren't things that were designed to become biological again. Okay. That's another way of framing what a technical nutrient is. It's something that's constructed to stay as a technical nutrient, such as brass, wood, or silver, or gold, or in modern terms, of course, plastic, which is probably, of all the technical nutrients, it's probably the biggest deal right now, right? Mm-hmm. You don't think of brass or copper or glass as being a problem, right? Even though we know that lead, for instance, was very toxic and can be very toxic. So anyway, that's the basics of the technical nutrients. This is a very complex diagram. And I didn't mean so much on a podcast to put up a complex diagram just to put minutia up there in front of everybody. So maybe if you have some questions about the basis of, sure, of this thinking, go ahead and ask.
Yeah. So would it be fair to say that a technological or technical nutrient is something that is created by humans, whereas the biological, yes, nutrients, yes, are created, yes, by the earth?
Yeah. The only distinction would be that minerals are obviously existing, but it's humans that understand what to do with the minerals and make it a technical nutrient. Correct.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And can you explain, there's this flow going on, right? There's these, the circles going in and out. Can you walk us through this process and this?
Well, on the biological side and the technical side, the key to the idea of circularity is that there is no waste. If you look at nature, mm-hmm, in nature, the biological nutrient side, which is where, in essence, this idea of circularity comes from looking at nature and how nature economizes. In nature, there is no such thing as waste. What appears as waste becomes food for something else. You know, when the tree falls down, the beetle takes it apart, the fungi take it apart, but it's not, the beetle and the fungus aren't bad things, right? That's just where they're getting their food from, the fallen tree. So, you know, that's the biological cycle that goes on. And the thing that's most important nowadays is to understand that, and this is why you used the word regenerative before. If I'd have known that was going to be a real important aspect, I have a whole little slide set about regeneration that I didn't include here. But regenerative is really the key to biological nutrient cycles staying cyclic, staying, making it. Mm-hmm. So it keeps that inner cascade that's shown on this diagram. That's regeneration. And that means it's solar powered. It means that the green cell is the value added. In other words, the fact that photosynthesis occurs is the reason we exist, you and I exist, right? I mean, maybe you guys took a class in ecology, this would always be one of the things they teach you right away. Mm-hmm. Is that photosynthesis is what makes the Earth somewhat profound compared to anything else they've found so far, right? They found water on other planets, right? But they haven't found fragments of, there's no green cells yet. So, so green cells are really what are the economic value added to the biological nutrient cycle. This is what sugars come are created, green cells, and that's where we get energy. Where we, you know, carbohydrates is where we get energy. The technical nutrient side is a little different in the sense that it's not returning to the soil, returning to the water in order to keep the cycle going. Mm-hmm. It's in effect in technical nutrient side is to keep it away from the soil and the water and the air. If you could, you wouldn't want it to expose itself to anything biological. If you could, you'd keep it safe from, because it doesn't integrate with biology. It's why we're calling it, that's why we're making this distinction actually. Mm-hmm. If it would reintegrate with biology, in other words, you can create a plastic that's a biological nutrient. Have you ever heard about what I'm describing right now?
Heard a little bit about
perhaps.
It.
Perhaps.
Okay, so you can create a plastic that'll compost. Mm-hmm. Okay, that'd be a biological nutrient. Okay, mm-hmm. But most plastics are not created that way. 99.9% aren't created that way. They aren't created to reintegrate with nature. They're created to, in fact, if anything, they degrade very slowly, and as they release toxins. They actually gather toxins in the ocean. That's been proven. The plastics actually draw toxic material to themselves in the oceans. So a technical nutrient, part of the logic behind a technical nutrient is to keep it out of the biological sphere, is to keep it in its own cycle. Mm. Glass becoming glass, aluminum becoming aluminum. Plastic becoming plastic again. That's kind of the optimum. It's not always the way it's happening, but that's the optimum thinking in terms of a theory. Again, mm-hmm. the question you're asking is about a theory of cycling. So that's what this represents. The recycling of a technical nutrient would be the least we could do. The smartest thing to do it would be to maintain it. If you can imagine, if you bought an automobile. You know, I don't know, again, I'm not trying to sound like I'm the old guy talking to young people all the time, but there's some of that dynamic in this conversation. Had you ever thought that maybe we're going to become to the point that we build a car that you can own one car your whole life and all you do is need to maintain it?
That would be amazing.
Yeah. So that would be the optimum type of technical nutrient use, you know,
right.
then there's reuse and repairing, you know. Then, you know, refurbishing, these are all better than recycling.
Yeah. Modular technology.
Yeah. Modular. Exactly. No, you're on it. Yeah. Very good. Very good. Yeah.
I'm noticing my initial reaction to that question was actually no, because I feel like I've been so trained to want new things, new products, right? For example, you know, the new iPhone comes out every year. There's a new MacBook or there's a new model of a Tesla, for example, right? And so we're like being members of this consumer-based economy where we're constantly being marketed and fed new and better products that do cool new things that you must have now. My initial reaction was like, well, what if I want the new better thing? Like, do I really want the same old thing for my whole life? But I suppose, you know, if we could imagine having products and technologies that are more durable and meant to evolve, as Samir was saying, to be modular, then certainly that would be the kind of the best of both worlds, because you could still upgrade and enhance your products and technologies, but you wouldn't necessarily have to wholesale replace and waste, you know, whatever existing thing you have.
Go ahead and say it, trash it, you know, just trash it.
Yeah.
If it was more modular, or at least you could take it apart again and build something else with the parts, you know, at least it would have, again, from an economic point of view, it would keep value and it'd keep value. That's another way of saying what a circular economy is trying to achieve is trying to be economical with material, is trying to not waste it on purpose. Mm-hmm. It's, you know.
It could have a lot of really great implications. Obviously, less waste is one, less garbage, but it could also, I could imagine, making things a lot easier as far as issues of compatibility. We have so many different brands of electronics that you always have to watch for those compatibility issues. Sometimes you find yourself throwing things away, not because they don't work anymore, they're not any good anymore, but they just aren't compatible with what other electronics you have. But if we transition to more modular, refurbished products, you could potentially see a future where people, everyone has access to the most optimal technology available at that period in time, which could, you know, enhance communication globally, which is, we're becoming more and more connected globally. But if we could get past these issues of compatibility as well, that could be another really great benefit for modular or refurbished products. And also, like, as far as, you know, everybody likes something new and shiny. I could see the possibilities, you know, with technology as well, being able to maintain the options for personalization and, you know, sprucing things up or making yourself feel like you have something new with, like, LEDs that could be personalized. You could change the colors. Cells are getting smaller and smaller. You can have a finish on a car that's looks like paint, but it's actually very small LEDs. You could change the color every day if you wanted to. So I don't think they're necessarily opposing options. I think that it's very possible to have personalization and that sense of something being new, but also having it last and be a very good quality product that doesn't create a lot of waste.
Could you imagine your car color changes when it's your birthday that day and everybody knows it's your birthday that day?
Yes, that would be awesome. I would love that.
Birthday paint.
Birthday so cake. Exactly. I enjoy the way you're thinking. It's fun to think this way because to the commonality that you're alluding to, it, you know, besides the singular planet we live on, there are a few things that modern society has developed with commonality. And of course, the internet is one thing mm-hmm. that has a commonality aspect to it. But think of some other things that have a commonality aspect to it. Okay. Radio frequencies, the radio you would use, it's a frequency thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the frequency is the frequency. It doesn't matter. It's going to work that way no matter where you are on the planet. Okay, so one of my favorite things to point out this way is the periodic table. The periodic table elements is the same place in China, same looking thing in China as it is in the United States, as it is in Russia.
Right.
And any place else, it's the periodic table. Those elements don't change accordingly. That's another way of saying what the circular economy is about to a certain extent. Don't take it overstep what I'm about to say. Mm-hmm. But it's about understanding how the material, all the molecules on the planet, how they operate in a cycle so that it doesn't stress the planet anymore. Mm-hmm. So all the stuff moves around in a way that's more elegant. And this ability to be modular is obviously a very good insight into this idea. You know, why can't choice be something that is built into something rather than something you have to create a built-in obsolescence for?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next slide. Exciting here. To think about. We have the tunnel through the funnel.
So we're talking about resources. And okay, so this is from The Natural Step. And if anybody hasn't heard about The Natural Step, it's I just pulled up the website to make sure I had it right. United States is called thenaturalstep.org, and in Canada it's naturalstep.ca. Those are the two websites for The Natural Step. So this comes out of The Natural Step, this pictogram. And so you look at these two funnels, the left and the right, they come through in the middle, we call a tunnel. Okay. Okay, so the funnel on the left-hand side and the funnel on the right-hand side. You understand the metaphor so far? So good?
Yes, it's great.
Okay. So if you take the line on the left-hand side funnel, the line there shows those the resource decreasing as we extract and use up things. So the actual amount of petroleum, the actual amount of iron ore, the actual amount of especially rare earth minerals, you know, there's this crisis with certain things. All these things that are relatively scarce on the planet are being used up. So that's declining, right? So that's why you have the funnel on the left-hand side with the slope going down from the left to the right. The funnel, the bottom of that funnel, that's the human population going up and a demand for that same stuff. So if there wasn't a tunnel, in other words, take your mind's eye and have the declining resources meet the increasing demand. What happens eventually?
Not a good situation.
Yeah.
Not a good situation. Thank you. That's a nice way to say it, by the way. Not a good situation. War, famine, you name it, right? And we claim that people in the circular economics community claim that take, make, waste, which is the linear economy alluded to before, and I'll explain that more in a pictogram or two later here, that take, make, waste is driving this not where you want to go scenario. Mm-hmm. So we claim that the tunnel to the restorative, so that there's more resources and potential zero population growth. And I'll make a point there. Have you heard of the Drawdown Project, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Institute.
I'll allude to that to talk about the restorative side then. But basically, the sustainability part, the tunnel, is learning how to be circular, so that we don't accumulate waste. That waste becomes food instead. That resources become usable again and again. Okay, that's the sustainability, and then the restorative side. In Drawdown, you realize that one of the keys to restoration of the planet is the liberation and education of females. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you want to control population, just make the female part of the population intelligent and empowered and equally and socially equal. Mm-hmm. And that it tends to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And it's very profound. It's very correct. It's been shown again and again that helps much more than any other nefarious types of way to how to solve population control. It just makes sure that we have a more equitable, more evenly, I guess it's non-sexist. You help me with words here. What is the best way to describe this future that we're talking about?
I think you're on the right track with it being more equitable. And studies have shown that women who are more educated have less children. And a lot of cultures where the women have children are in impoverished areas, they have multiple children because it's the norm that one or more of your children will die there. So that's another reason why a lot of women have a lot of children in impoverished areas. But the areas where they have access to education, they have less children. So I think you're on the right track with that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's not my theory. It's other people's. It's and so this is where you get, this is why, and the resource increasing comes from this restorative thinking about modularity, refurbishing, you know, not wasting, what's the next life of something, not the end of life. Mm-hmm. That's why that funnel starts on the way up. And the resources start back up and the population starts to decline and we have a more generative world of plenty. So this is from the natural step. And the natural step has four systems conditions. Do you mind if I read them out to you?
Go for it.
So there's four systems conditions to a sustainable society. And systems condition number one is in a sustainable society, nature is not subject to systematically increasing, number one, concentrations of substances extracted from the Earth's crust. Okay. For example, heavy metals and fossil fuels. Number two, concentration of substances produced by society, produced by humans. Mm-hmm. Examples of this would be plastics or dioxins or PCB or DDT. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the chemistry that we found out didn't work. It worked one life and then it got problematic. Those things increasing concentration are a problem. So we want to avoid that. Three, third system condition is degradation by physical means. An example of that would be overharvesting forests or destroying habitat, overfishing, which we've had significant problems in the North Atlantic with overfishing. And the fourth condition is not so much as a scientific condition as the first three are all measuring things correctly, by the way, is learning if what we call climate change or climate chaos, carbon's not an evil thing. It's carbon in the wrong place in the wrong concentration. You follow?
Yeah, it's a great distinction.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the first three are kind of trying to allude to that awareness. Okay. The fourth is a little different, that in a society, people are not subject to conditions that systematically undermine their capacity to meet their needs, their basic needs. So it's a humanism is the fourth condition. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's like I said, drawdown gets into this pretty good in detail. Drawdown is an extension of Paul Hawkins' work that he started in The Natural Step. So it's worth knowing The Natural Step as a predecessor to Drawdown, by the way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I like about this image here, where you're illustrating the transition from the take, make, and waste paradigm through to the sustainable and then restorative 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. I like how you're labeling them as almost like versions of software, like we're upgrading the operating system of how we live on Earth. And in particular, it's interesting to see that there's actually a step beyond just simply being sustainable, right? We hear about this goal for companies to become sustainable brands, and that's admirable and a step in the right direction. But just simply to sustain where we are right now is not necessarily the goal. What I think this image is pointing out is we can actually do more than simply being sustainable. We can actually restore and regenerate the natural environment that we've systematically destroyed over the last, you know, several thousand years.
Yep.
So let's move on to the next slide here.
The oak tree is Carl Henrik Robert, the founder of The Natural Step. He uses the oak tree as a metaphor. And what he's trying to express to people is that, here's a picture of the oak tree, right? That's the oak tree. Well, that's just half of the oak tree. Oak tree is a very interesting species. There's very similar mass and very similar construction under the ground.
Wow.
So, first of all, the first thing he tries to point out is, well, the oak tree is twice as big as you say it is through your normal awareness. And that's true, right?
Right.
Obviously, if there weren't any roots, there wouldn't be any trunk. So without that systemic root system into the earth. And the other thing, of course, is that the oak tree exists because it is connected to the earth. So this is another point he makes. Notice things and how they're connected to the earth. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing he talks about, and when he uses the oak tree metaphor for, is that, well, it's also a good metaphor to talk about humans, how humans talk about science and things and politics. He says humans are often, they're very good at talking about the trunk, you know, and then they'll talk about the overall problem. The trunk is what he'll say the overall problem is. And then they'll talk about minutia, and he calls that chatter in the leaves. Mm. And so his point is that we tend to not talk about the whole thing. And then when we do talk about it, we talk about sort of parts. And specifically frustrating is that we assume that the trunk immediately means that the very external things are the next thing to talk about. And yet there's obviously branches and all sorts of things in between. Mm-hmm. And so in order to think about any particular solution, we have to think systemically is his point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that. I appreciate it. It reminds me of Andrew Yang's whole perspective on how we can change the economy for the better. And he, you know, he's proposing the freedom dividend, you know, UBI, to provide people an economic floor from which, you know, they can stand upon. And, you know, he's making the argument that, you know, if we can simply give people money, that it would solve a lot of the other downstream effects of the way that our economy is not really helping people survive in the right way. And this idea of like chatter in the wind, like, yeah, we can talk about, you know, poverty and homelessness, but there's some deeper rooted issues. And
yes,
yeah, it's a good reminder, this image here of the oak tree, of how important it is when we're thinking about addressing social issues to, like you said, to use systemic thinking and to recognize or to be able to discern the difference between when something is simply putting a Band-Aid over an issue, or really looking at it from the root cause.
Yep. Well stated. Thank you.
Yeah. So let's move on to this next one here. We got some of the simple rules to follow for sustainability.
Yeah, this is kind of ecology 101. I mean, if people want to understand what I mean by sustainability, I learned this a long time ago, and a lot of people say the same thing, so it's not like my personal theory. It's just, you know, simplify it to two things so that it's easy to understand. We need to live off of current solar income, and that does kind of mean that solar and wind energy are a big part of our future, but so is tidal energy. But so is, you ever heard the phrase megawatts? Megawatts?
No.
A guy named Amory Lovins coined it. Amory Lovins coined it, and it's a very good. So to not use energy is also a way to live off of current solar energy, to not use fossil energy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's ways to live off of current solar income, and the cyclic principle, which is that waste is food. Again, back to this concept, there's no bioaccumulation of toxins of human-made origin in nature. It doesn't exist. So go ahead, next. Go ahead to the next slide.
Absolutely.
So there is no way. There's this idea that we throw away things is kind of a funny nomenclature, a funny way to think. Again, this is kind of like back to the, why did we think the Earth was flat for so long? Or why did we think the Earth was the center of the solar system for so long? I don't know, because there never is an away. If you wanted to show me where the away is, I'd like to know. There is no away.
You know? So, yeah, I really appreciate this one. I was scrolling through the images before we started streaming here, and that really struck me as something that was simple but profound, because we are very much used to this concept and this phrase of throwing, you know, quote, throwing something away. But then when you stop and think about, what does that really mean? Well, where is away? Where does our trash go? And we really take for granted the way in which our garbage and other materials are, you know, whisked away somewhere that we don't see. And yet they are, you know, sitting in the ocean or some other landfill.
Very well stated. There's no end of life, and there's often, even in the recycling business, even in the green head world, people will say, talk about end of life, not in a circular economic sense. If you talk about end of life, you might as well talk about throwing it away, because what you're doing is saying it's wasted. You could say end of purpose, maybe. Mm-hmm. Something that won't be true, but end of life is kind of a strange way to say it, because what you want to do is you want to make sure that everything has a next life, everything has a next purpose. That's what makes it circular, that's what makes it continuous.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we know what occurs to me in this new paradigm is it's infusing more awareness, more consciousness in the way that we produce and create products and live, both from the manufacturing process, but as well as, you know, the promotion and distribution of everything. It seems like the paradigm is shifting from sort of, I wouldn't necessarily say thoughtless, but maybe more careless, laissez-faire, just create something and, you know, who cares or who knows where it ends up in the future. But now we see that that level of thinking is pretty destructive and, in fact, self-destructive. And we are and have carried that paradigm out to its logical conclusion, which is the just, you know, destruction of the basic life support systems that we need to survive as humans, as well as all the animals and plants that are sharing this planet with us. And moving into a circular economy is clearly the you know, at least what I'm gathering from our conversation here is like, is obviously the way of the future, but I'm wondering to what extent people are even aware of this concept or like how far are we from really realizing this vision of the circular economy?
Wow. Okay. That's not as heavy as Summer's question. We'll ease it. I think it's important that we have institutional change. So I would suggest if I were dictator of the policy that all anybody getting a degree in economics and who hasn't got one yet in any high school economics class that they at least mention this concept, this theory. Mm-hmm. And they can call it a theory. That's fine. I don't, you know, I'm not so stuck with the word that it has to be the way to do things. But I do think if people are taught what a circular economy is, and then they are taught what extractive economy is, it becomes pretty obvious to them that the extractive economy is not economical. Mm. That it's creating costs on society that somebody's got to pay for.
Right.
You know, so who's paying for it? I mean, you know, at least to start bringing these questions up to every single student in economics, that would be a good thing, Cosmos. That would be a really good thing. If people just started to at least discuss, well, wait a minute, there's got to be a way to think about so that the irony being that so that the study of economics becomes economical.
Right.
Exactly. Now, I've always pointed out that this is the problem I had when I learned economics was that, well, I learned this theory about economics that was not economical. That's I've said that a few times. And I do think that if all the econ departments at least started giving space for this, this is not ooey-ooey. This is grounded. The EU, China, there's some other places have taken this very seriously. They have very serious paths. I would guess that all course matter in China and the EU now, if you're studying economics in high school or college and in those places, they mention the circular economy. I think it's normal. Mm-hmm. The United States is not, unfortunately, one of the most forward-thinking places when it comes to this because a lot of people in the United States are still getting wealthy off of the extractive economy, unfortunately.
Right.
You know, there hasn't been the feedback loop yet that says this is not a good way to do this. Which we'll discuss here as we move through these slides.
Sure. Let's continue here. But I just want to mention, it's like so long as we are financially incentivized to use a process that is not necessarily aligned with the health of the planet or our own bodies, then we're going to continue using that process until the economics of it are inverted.
Correct. Nice way to say that. That's sort of why I put this slide up here. This is every part of the system right now. We use raw materials and energy, and then there's waste in each use. Mm-hmm. There's waste in extraction, waste in production, waste in distribution, waste in use, waste in disposal, and the emissions. And the irony is that the people that make money at this, people that profit from this, they're internalizing the profits and externalizing the costs. So mm-hmm. The bottom half of this diagram is all externalized onto the the public's got to pay for it somehow. Mm-hmm. So is that really going to happen? In a pandemic, with the pandemic expenses coming to fore, who's going to pay for all the emissions in the air and water and all the waste if we continue to waste stuff? Mm. You know, who's paying for that? Well, as we're finding out in the pandemic, the poor and the marginalized pay more than anybody else. They pay with their lives. And there'll be some, if we don't become circular soon, but again, I'd say to your previous question, I think the EU and China, which one's a socialist state and one's very capitalist organization, they both seem to understand that we need to stop polluting. Mm-hmm. You know, so they know that true cost is a better way to do things. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how it's going to be built into our system exactly. But I, as I said before, I don't think price point at $2 a gallon of gasoline helps us. I think that price shows is that that's the cost of extraction and distribution, extraction, refinement, and distribution. That's what that price says. It doesn't say anything about the other costs that are created by the production and use and combustion of that material.
Right, and it's also a projected or it's somewhat imagined cost, because a lot of things we use, if they actually cost as much as it costs to extract and transport them, they would cost thousands and thousands of dollars. Like, we get strawberries from South America. Why do we do that in Southern California? Why does that happen? We can grow strawberries here. That's just a small example, but there's a lot of different flaws in that approach. And I think that I'm sure that local economies can do a lot more than it right now than just trying to up and decide to change the entire economy, the global economy.
Well, to the previous point one of you made about parallel, I do think we need a parallel set of books, a true cost set of books that's mm-hmm. published. I've been on groups about this. This is not my own thinking. This is a lot of other people's thinking, by the way. So true cost accounting is called. You can look it up. And I do think, I wish that would more normal, just like the circular economy. I wish all the econ classes would teach true cost accounting, again, as an alternative to linear accounting.
Right. Real quick, true cost, does that mean embodying the externalities within
The fancy way to say it is internalizing the externalities. Yes.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's something that Charles Eisenstein goes on about.
Yes.
That seems really important.
Yes.
To creating a future sacred, in his book, Sacred Economics, a really amazing book.
It is.
Yeah. That's one of the main things, along with, I think, a negative interest rate that he talks about.
Well, there's a branch here talking about the tree metaphors. Yeah, if we talk about money and you know, for instance, I just want to mention this aside because you mentioned Charles, and he writes really, people should read him. You're correct. That's the first thing people should do is try to read everything he's ever written. He's a brilliant guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when I hear people saying that the federal government can't print money to help the states through this pandemic, all the deficits, states are going backwards because their taxes, unfortunately, and their revenue, a lot of it's based on this conspicuous consumption that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's that, you know, they don't get all the taxes from the restaurants, from any number of places that they used to get taxes from. Okay, so they're hurting. And then I hear that, well, if the government prints money, it'll create inflation. Well, that's kind of an old myth. That's not a myth, really. It's true in post-war Germany, or during a war in Germany or Japan, or any case where this has really happened. The government printed money. And of course, you had more money chasing fewer goods because the war had destroyed everything.
Oh, wow. Right? Yeah. Good point.
So that obviously does create inflation. you have more money chasing fewer goods, so price is going to go up. Well, but if you have more money chasing stable supply, the stable goods, it's not necessarily going to be inflationary if it's just substituting for the money that it would have otherwise been there. Now, everybody, of course, who's on the other side of this argument, also in the background is saying, well, those people are just sitting on their butts. They're not working. You know, they're getting $1,000 a week in unemployment. They're being disincentivized to work. Well, is that, you really think most people just want to sit on their butts, by the way? No, they don't. Of course they don't. And so that it's always hard to hear that, by the way. I just had to bring this up because I hear this a lot in the talking heads
nowadays.
You know,
it's getting old hearing that.
Yes, it is getting old. And these ideas of negative income taxes or basically a common floor, which, by the way, is what if you think about some of the countries that people have. Well, when people make an example of the way Sweden handled a pandemic, they right away should make the point that Sweden has socialized healthcare.
Exactly.
So Sweden has a floor already for everybody. You know, back to that language. It's a very good metaphor to call it a floor. Mm-hmm. So it you know, if you had a floor for healthcare, for basic foodstuffs, for education, for communication like the internet, if that floor was presided, I don't know if people would be lazier. They might be more creative. They might be less sad, but I don't know if they're going to be lazy just because of that. Anyway, that's just my take.
No, that's a good point. And shout out to our first guest of the podcast, Larry Cohen, for creating Build the Floor, which is an organization that is promoting universal basic income. And you can learn more about what his work is with that by listening to the first episode.
Yes. Cool. So let's hope the federal government gets smart and helps the states through this process, and it'll float all boats, including, you know, the trivia that during the pandemic, the billionaires have become, just in 3 months, billionaires in the world have become 16 percentage points wealthier in just 3 months. So we have this trickle-up phenomenon, and the inequity is getting worse. Again, what is the word economics trying to describe? Isn't it trying to describe economical?
Yeah.
Right.
So resource management is what it's supposed to be about.
No, it's just wealth accumulations. He who has more toys wins. That's it.
Yeah. Okay. Like you mentioned about the question of whether people are going to be lazy, I think it's a little bit ridiculous when people try to make that argument against giving people a floor, but it made me think of how we were talking about educating women and the side effect that has on the amount of children that they have. And I think it all boils down to purpose. Everyone desires to have a sense of purpose, and it looks different in every culture. In impoverished countries and third world countries, a woman's sense of purpose may very well be to be a mother. In America, it might be to have a really great paying job with benefits and, you know, good retirement. So I think that our culture definitely influences people's sense of purpose, but I don't think that it determines if they have a sense of purpose or not. I think that's something naturally intrinsic to the human being, is the desire to create and have a sense of purpose.
Well said.
If everybody was ecologically literate, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right.
It would take care of itself. It would, because people would know better than to shit in their own house. You know?
It's true. It's very true.
Yeah. So this is just to express the problem of the wasting problem we're having right now. That despite all the efforts with recycling and composting, man, the wasting is just still incredible right now. That's what this pictogram's about.
And, tip of the wasteberg.
The tip of the wasteberg. And again, this is somebody else's metaphor, not mine. I borrowed it. Composting is the thing that we really need to work on in California, by the way. despite all the we sound enlightened to ourselves. We talk about having the ability to compost this and that, and we still aren't doing very good. I think we're at about 10% of what we could do now, and you know we're supposed to be at 50% of what we could do now by law. Mm-hmm. We have a law about this in California, by the way, of getting our compostable materials composted. Mm-hmm. And it's under AB 1383, I think. It's basically part of the climate change legislation that we have in California. Compost is very important to reducing the amount of carbon because it makes the soil healthy. It makes the soil healthier. By healthier soil, will draw down more carbon. So it's a big deal. Go ahead with the next slide. This was just for the sake of expressing to people that. We're recycling better and composting better, at least before the pandemic, but we're really not doing very much at all. Mm-hmm. So this is just to get back to the circular economic nomenclature. Let me bring it up on the big screen here so I can read it easy. Do you guys know the book Cradle to Cradle?
No, I have not heard of it.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so there's a book. Is written in 2002 by Bill McDonough and Michael Brongardt. Bill McDonough is a relatively famous architect and a consultant to China, by the way, to nation state, to the president and premiers of China. He brought the idea of a circular economics to them in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And then Michael Brongardt, who's a German, who equally done the same thing in the EU. That's why I know that those places are doing more than other places, because McDonough and Brongardt have had an effect. And so this is his quote, his two fundamental frameworks for metabolism, biological and technical nutrients. So we ask a company, this is talking about a goal or perception. Are your materials safe and healthy for human and ecological systems? Do you have reverse logistics? Do you know where this stuff comes from? Where it goes and how it gets back and it onto closed zero waste cycles. So this is the crux of the question we need to be asking corporate America and government. The military needs to be asked this question too, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's everybody who uses stuff a lot. Mm-hmm. We need to ask them this question. So go ahead to the next slide.
Yeah.
So again, this is just to reiterate, but products of consumption of biological nutrients in a biological cycle versus compostables become a soil amendment. So it's a cycle of take, make, regenerate. Take, make, regenerate. It's not a take, make, waste. It's a self-reinforcing loop of regeneration. Mm. This is nature. This is how nature works. This is why nature has lasted so long. Relatively human.
So far, yeah.
So far.
Absolutely.
Yeah, until this. Yeah. Hold that thought, because I want to make a pun about what you just said. So if you can remember that thought, if I come back to ask you about when you say human so far.
Okay.
Because it has to do with current events. So technical nutrients or products and services are in a technical cycle, and this is plastics, glass, and metals. So again, it's the regeneration loop is the material, the molecules. It's probably better to maybe even use, I mean, materials is a bigger way to say molecules, but everything's molecules. And you know, when you've heard the word polymer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is plastics. Mm-hmm. Okay. Polymer just means a big molecular chain. That's what polymer means. Mm-hmm. We need, if we can break the polymer into its molecular structure or what structured the polymer, that's fine too, as far as recycling the technical nutrient, by the way. So a plastic can become its component parts again. That would be intelligent if we knew how to do that. Now, the reason I say this is you read about this in polymer magazines and plastic magazines, like they can do it tomorrow, but as far as I can tell, it's not so simple yet. Part of the problem I find with plastics, and the reason I kind of put the slide up there, was that plastics, they do suffer from the fact that there are too many of them and too many variations. Mm-hmm. So when you go to recycle them, they have less value. In other words, there's so many different molecules that are they're colorants, softeners, things that make it stretchier. All those things are added, and they don't know how to depolymerize them in a simple way. They just know they can do it theoretically. My point to you would be, if plastics were designed from the first step is to design the polymer so that it recycles well, that would be a good concept. Mm-hmm. That would be, you know, we may have it in PET, by the way. Number one may already be there. And number two seems to recycle pretty well. Number five seems to recycle pretty well, polypropylene. But again, if you add other things, colorants, anything that's not the polymer is a potential contaminant for its recycling. So even the three that recycle well, theoretically, they just because they have those numbers on the plastic doesn't mean they recycle easily, because they may have other molecules in them that aren't designed to recycle. Or they make the next life more brittle, or they make the next life softer. In other words, it's a problem. Go ahead with the next slide.
Sure. And I have a quick question before we talk about this one. Would you say that one of the central challenges towards moving into a regenerative paradigm is figuring out a way to recycle and remake plastic being one of the main challenging materials?
Plastic's genius and challenging all in one loop. It isn't. It's amazing. I had a car, a Camry hybrid for 13 years, and I just got myself a new Camry hybrid. Same car, same length. It weighs 20% less. The reason it weighs 20% less is it's got plastic. It's where metals used to be, it's got plastics.
Makes sense.
So it's brilliant from a and it's supposed to be just as good, right? You know, theoretically, it's supposed to be just as safe. So there's a genius in them. At the same time, that they designed those polymers with the idea that they were going to recover them sometime. You know, probably not. And I'm not knocking it. I'm not trying to self-flagellate myself for what I did. But what I'm trying to say is, it's just too bad that isn't the protocol now. That the protocol should be you it's stronger and lighter, is it easy to recover, should be asked at the same time. So I do think it's a problem. Glasses, you know, recycles relatively easy. Aluminum and steel recycle relatively easily. And it's smart to recycle all three of those, because making virgin glass and steel and aluminum takes a lot of energy. So it'd be very smart.
But not
that's the advantage plastics have over anybody, over other materials, is that they're so easy energetically to quote unquote recycle. If they recycle, they are
if
very
easy.
If they recycle, yeah.
Gotcha. Cool. So what are we looking at now?
What kind of polymers?
On the slide.
No, we're moving on to the next one.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Just to kind of we're sort of getting, we want to summarize some things and okay. The linear economy is basically, for all its growth in GDP and everything, it's very fascinating. GDP is gross national product, or GDP, gross domestic product. They include in those numbers. Those numbers grow up when there's more waste right now.
Yeah. So that leads me to one of my questions here, which is, how does our focus on the GDP as a measurement of success affect our ability to create a regenerative economy?
It doesn't help us at all. It's conscious obsolescence time. It's had its day. It came out of a think tank that called the Wizards or something. It is a 1930s depression era of brilliant, you know, it was Harvard and Yale, a bunch of brilliant guys from Harvard and Yale that got together, and they created these new economic indicators. And to them, more using up more energy, using up more petroleum was a way to grow. And I've always joked about it, but yeah, I said, if you want to become a 400-pound man, You know, is perpetual growth really the goal?
Right.
You know, that's what GDP is kind of all about, is perpetual growth. And it means perpetual material growth, too. We're not talking about spiritual growth here. We're not talking about inner growth.
Right. Well, and it's fitting in America in particular, a nation where a significant portion of our population is overweight or obese. So it's like matching that physical.
No, it's a very good point. Do you happen to know this data there?
No, I don't know offhand what percentage of that. Maybe it's something someone can look into, but I know it's pretty alarming. Pretty alarming.
Including President Twitter.
Right.
Who Nancy Pelosi the other day said something about him being morbidly obese. She's a San Francisco person. And so I wanted to know right away if she was quoting it statistically or not. That's why when you mentioned that, I went, oh, that's right. I think it's 30% of the population is obese.
Yeah,
I think that's the statistic.
42.4%.
Obese?
As of 2018.
No way. Mm-hmm. 42% of Americans are obese?
Is there a distinction about morbidly obese? Is morbidly obese
Let's see. Go ahead. I think that's a different statistic. Let's see.
No, that's just curious.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to put us on this tangent, but it was interesting when you brought it up.
Sure.
Okay.
So right now.
No, but you're right. You're right about the. I think you're right about the relationship to. For instance, fast food is probably part of the problem with most of these people, right? Most of these people that are morbidly obese, they eat too many calories that are empty,
right?
And that's driven by the extraction economy. It's driven by the fossil fuel.
Right. Yeah. Wow. It's so interesting. It's like the focus on GDP as a measurement of success, right? This growth at all costs is physically manifested in the diseased, obese bodies, the physicality of our population.
For the technical term of morbid obesity, the BMI has to be over 40. It says that's 6.6% of the American population, which is about 15 million people.
Crazy.
That's still a lot of people.
That's a lot of people, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And those people, that's kind of a sad statistic. That's very bad. Yeah,
definitely so not. Next slide. Good. You got it.
So again, just to remind the cradle to cradle nomenclature is very useful. I would like policy. I would like any time people talk about zero waste policy, I wish they would use the cradle to cradle nomenclature to describe what they mean. When they talk about composting, I wish they might as well call it biological nutrients. And you notice that the living systems line, you notice that the biological nutrients in this pictogram, the cycling touches the living system.
Right.
Okay. And you notice the technical nutrients does not touch the living system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the ideal in a circular economy.
Mm.
And again, this is from McDonough and Brongard. This diagram.
So
okay, next.
Yeah, you got it.
So again, just another way of thinking it. There's the cycles of nature. Everything that's brought us here, and then there's the cycles of industry. And if we can change industry's mind so that it doesn't pollute nature, that's what we're trying to do. That's another way of framing of how we're trying to talk about this. No way to talk about it. You had some questions.
Oh, yeah. So we're talking about the technological and the biological nutrient cycles as the main elements within this circular economy. But could there be other distinct cycles that are not encapsulated by those two categories?
If you combine them, you get monstrous hybrids. You get if you combine the two cycles in any way, I mean, this is why they're so distinct. That's why I use this slide here, cycles of nature, cycles of industry, or cycles created by the human mind versus cycles that are that are part of evolution is another way of saying it. The cycles that are part of evolution, they, as far as we know, including their viruses, we can deal with them. The cycles of industry, if we don't learn how to make them cyclic, they will destroy, they will toxify us to the point that we are the ones that are obsolete. The concept that you're talking about, we joke about it in material when it comes to sustainable material management, is monstrous hybrids. That's actually the language we use. We talk about it as monstrous. In other words, they come out with materials that are most common one would be a polymer fused to a metal. Not layered to metal. There's difference. You can layer, by the way, this is part of kind of the distinction we're trying to draw in this nomenclature. You can layer a biopolymer with aluminum foil, and you can put them through a process that separates the two of them and gets each of them recycled differently. But if you fuse the polymer to the foil, you make a monstrous hybrid. So there is a way to do it to where the material isn't a monstrous hybrid versus multi-laminates tend to fuse things like your potato chip bag. Mm-hmm. It tends to be neither a cycle of nature or a cycle of industry. It tries to do both and it doesn't work. At best, it becomes you could maybe make it into a park bench, but then as the park bench degrades, it's degrading toxicity. So you can kind of lock it up for a minute, but you haven't done this. Go back. I don't want you to go back. But that's why the diagram about the nomenclature,
right,
that technical nutrients are not designed to be, they're not designed to be back in the living system.
Gotcha. Yeah, I guess I was wondering, not necessarily about combining the two, but rather if there were other categories that might be outside of those two options.
Peter Drucker, you know that name?
No.
Well, Peter's done a lot of things, including he deserves a lot of credit for the way Japan came back from World War II as a management consultant. And so he's written in several books about competitive advantage. And significant competitive advantage lies in those organization individuals who anticipate well in turbulent times. So anticipatory design is kind of the theme here. And that's sort of where we need to head is mm-hmm. anticipatory design. Because, next slide, otherwise, there's major ramifications ahead. I always thought that was a cute slide here, this one here. Mm-hmm. So, and then next slide. So when we talk about moving from an industrial age or from a linear economy or an extractive economy to a circular economy, we are talking about, we're talking about understanding how nature has an economy that works, yet modernizing it. So mm-hmm. when we say fossil fuels and energy to the sun, we're not saying just rely on the sun. We're saying photovoltaics. We're saying wind energy is sun energy, by the way. You probably know that. It's solar energy, just a different way of it happens. Tidal energy mm-hmm. is the sun and the moon, the way that works with each other. How we design buildings, we should have solar orientation with all buildings. I mean, could you imagine that all the new houses in Southern California were oriented towards the southern exposure correctly? Mm-hmm. And had solar panels built on them at the same time.
That would be pretty amazing.
Any new dwelling, I mean, it would change people's thinking about how things work. That's what we mean by shifting from fossil fuels to sun. Okay, mm-hmm. from extractive to renewables. It will take some fossil fuels to build the renewable infrastructure. By the way, that's true. Okay. Some of the solar panels use metals. Okay. Use silica. Okay. Wind turbines obviously use metals and plastics. Okay.
Yeah.
But it's as a ratio and as a cost. There's a very fancy thing called biophysical economics, by the way. If you ever want to read about this transition from fossil fuel to solar-based energy systems, and instead of back to this kind of true cost metaphor, instead of everything just the cost of extraction plus refinement plus distribution, you measure the actual energy cost of getting it done for the energy cost return. It's energy recovered by, or let's see, energy invested by energy returned, I believe is the metaphor that they use in biophysical economics. But it's a whole subject in itself. And it explains much better than I could this whole transition of why we can move from fossil fuel to solar energy. Will things cost more? Well, I think that's relative. Will it cost more to drive a fossil fuel car? I hope so. But will it cost more to ride electronic public transportation? I hope not. So will airplanes cost a lot? I'm not really sure. This is an open question, by the way. You can read about it yourself. Mm-hmm. A jet engine can be done electronically, done electrically, by the way. In other words, you can create the same spiraling that a jet engine. You can have an electric jet engine. So how committed we are to that technology is a way to say how we can make this shift. When it comes to food, I think Summer brought it up. Obviously, global production is not as necessary for humans as local production. Global production is trickle-up economics. Should food be produced globally, ecologically? Of course. Okay, that's true too. But that doesn't mean that at the local level is the way we should try to grow food within a 100-mile radius of where the population is. We shouldn't have humans populate places that can't live off of a 100-mile radius. Mm-hmm. That's a good way to frame it, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's when I consulted
with Whole Foods for a while, they had a written edict that they were trying to do 400-mile radius. It got squashed, but it was actually a good goal to at least state something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and so local is very important. And to Summer's point, just because it's Southern California doesn't mean they couldn't have greenhouses in Southern California to grow coffee beans.
Mm-hmm. We really
you
have
could
the
have greenhouses in Southern California if you wanted to.
We do have the ability to recreate.
You could change
any environment.
The diet of Southern California so more people eat. You eat more seaweed. Same in Northern California. We could learn how to eat. I mean, the Japanese eat a lot of seaweed. They're healthier than we are. Mm-hmm. You know. So, I mean, to that point, that's what that shift's about. Obviously, the waste burden is the huge waste to, I don't know if we can go to no waste. I always say that zero waste is aspirational rather than an absolute.
Right.
Because people try to not, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah.
Sounds like you had something on your mind.
No, it's a good point. You know, we talk about zero waste and, well, I mean, you mentioned to us previously how it's more of an aspiration and not necessarily something that is even physically achievable in the absolute, you know, purest sense of the idea.
Yeah, it's if we were recycling at an 80% rate right now, you and I wouldn't be having this discussion. Mm-hmm. We'd be in a very relatively stabilizing society, but we're nowhere near that kind of number. Okay.
Right.
I have a question related to that. I'm wondering, when you mentioned zero waste being not achievable, it makes me wonder about Bucky's term ephemeralization, where he talks about creating more with less up until the point of where you're creating off of itself out of nothing. What are your thoughts on that? Is that feasible?
Yeah, what's Jeremy Rifkin call it, the zero margin? Yeah, mm-hmm. Jeremy Rifkin has a book out about the same concept that Bucky had. Basically, the no margin economy or low margin economy. I think obviously, for somebody who first used a computer to do when I was at UCSD, the computer we used to do our senior project, which is an econometric model where the you know what your bathroom's about 5x8, right? The normal bathroom, I think, is about 5x8. That was the size of the computer we used to do that model. And now your smartphone probably, I don't know, 1,000 times more effective than that 5x8x8 computer. So I'd say we are ephemeralizing to a certain extent. It's pretty obvious that we are. Now, what we're not doing is more to the point of we're not all 6 foot tall and 170 pounds, right? We're more like 6 foot and 300 pounds. So we're going backwards in some ways, right? We got more automobiles on the planet than ever before too, before the pandemic at least. More people are into automobiling than ever before. Yeah. So in some ways, we're going backwards as far as, you know.
So
go ahead with your comments.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this would be a great question to wrap up with, which is, you know, you've had decades of experience working within the organic farming movement and seeing the evolution of the circular economy. What has surprised you about the way that our world or the economy has evolved, and what changes do you see as being necessary for us to make to really achieve this vision of a regenerative society going forward?
Well, in some ways, that's why I have the last slide there, this final slide, because when EcoCycle created this thing in 2005, I gravitated right away to it. I was consulting with Whole Foods Market at the time and creating a thing called the Green Mission with them. And had already, I think, put together 9 different regional composting systems. And I was looking at these aspects, if you will, the zero economy. And I decided that basically working on all 9 of these things at once was really a smart thing to do, you know. And so obviously I was working on the retail store part, and that's why they actually sent this to me. But I immediately got involved a lot more in clean production, and producer responsibility. And, I actually have a small project now in a resource recovery park. And I think we've already talked about in this conversation about designing for environment, not the dump. In other words, true cost accounting, design for the next life, all that kind of stuff we talked about already. Changing the rules, I think we talked a little bit about policy. Mm-hmm. I do think policy has to have the language of circular economics put into it. I would like to see new measurements. I'd like to see GDP go obsolete, just like we talked about. And I don't know exactly what's going to replace it. But, you know, again, back to the periodic table, carbon is a real thing. Okay, carbon's a real thing. It's measurable. The flows and the rates of the carbon are measurable. Dollars are metaphysical. Yet somehow we're able to measure dollars and we can't measure carbon as a culture. That's pretty funny, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
I mean, wouldn't you like to know if carbon was in the right place or not today? Of right. course you would.
To have a map of
you
that.
You know, the dollar thing is almost so good. We need to shift subsidies. It's really a big deal. We have perverse subsidies. It basically pays to be extractive. We have a pandemic, and the rich get not just kind of richer, they get a lot richer. I mean, the billionaires have accumulated another almost $100 billion in the last 90 days.
Wow.
I mean, that's a stunning amount of money, even though it's metaphysical, as I joke. You know, it's a stunning amount of money to go one way, you know, and they aren't going to necessarily create more jobs from it. I mean, jobs creating yachts and jobs creating personal jets, yes, but that's not real jobs, and that's not better, more local food for more people. Did you just disappear, or did the slide disappear?
Oh, I returned it back to the other screen.
That's okay. But we're kind of at this point where where all these things in that eco-cycle diagram are really important to kind of keep them in parallel, to create a parallel reality. I'm working on the retail store aspect. I'm working specifically on the stores not taking back things as much as creating take-back centers, back to the resource recovery park. Mm-hmm. I'm working on creating a thing called reverse retail.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
It's product and material take back, but it's not at the same store that you bought it from. It's because rather than Kmart doing it and Walmart doing it and Whole Foods doing it and Safeway doing it and Ralph's doing it and Stater Brothers doing it, all the same products that they sell, having it come back to a center, you know, I'm visualizing maybe 50 to 80 of these kind of things in California, just to give you kind of a scale sense, mm-hmm. you know, one per half million people or so. Because as far as reverse logistics, as far as getting it back into the cycle, it's almost better to have a source that's a magnet for the stuff rather than the store, which the store doesn't know how to deal with it very well. That was my experience. Like retailers weren't very good at reverse logistics. Not that they're horrible, by the way. Safeway, mm-hmm. for instance, in California, is very good at all the cardboard they ever use on the boxes gets back onto the market, for instance. Same with Whole Foods in California. Same mm-hmm. with Trader Joe's. They're very good at certain things, but not everything. It's too complex for them.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm working on kind of the opposite, again, it's a parallel idea, but it's not the same as EcoCycle saw it back then. I've kind of married part of what they had retail stores with resource recovery parks. But I think all these things are very intelligent ways to think about how to move things upstream better. And that's got to be part of our goal right now, so to learn how to move things upstream. Go ahead.
So if I understand you correctly, are you describing dedicated brick and mortar outlets that you can go to return your products or items in your home that can then be taken apart or recycled in some way? Is that accurate?
Yes.
Cool. That sounds pretty yes. useful.
There's places like this that exist in California, sort of, mm-hmm. but they're not. They're very entrepreneurial. They're not thought through. When you go into a Whole Foods or a Vons or a Ralph's, you're seeing something that's been really, really thought through about how to get the consumer to do certain things, how to get the customer in the store, and all that kind of stuff. So these resource recovery parts, there are models in California already, but they're with a couple of exceptions, they're one-offs. They're very unique situations. So this one person is engaging me to think about, well, what if it was designed as reverse retail? So it had the same idea, except it was meant for recovery, not meant for selling. Now, yeah. on the other side of it is, it does, you would sell things because you would sell refurbished things. You could refurbish a lot of things, you know. So, no, there's a market for building salvage, for instance. There's a good market for that. Anyway, this is just, I just wanted to kind of summarize it. You could do these circular things in the real world. It's just, it's going to take time and you have to think it through. You have to think it through from the culture. And I think I forget which gentleman you mentioned about talking about parallel realities. You have to kind of do it in a parallel reality point of view. I agree with that thinking. That makes sense to me.
Michael Tellinger.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't mind sending me some of your ideas back? You don't mind sending me some of your ideas?
Sure.
Because I appreciate them a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been a really enlightening conversation and really deeply appreciate your perspective on the circular economy and all the nitty gritty as to what that means and how we can get there. Where can people learn more about your work or about the circular economy in general?
Well, we want to make sure that we can make stuff more useful, longer periods of time, more utility, longer periods of time, more recoverable, more refurbishable. I mean, you know, you just keep thinking along that line, and it's not anti-economy. It's just a different economy. And it's hard to explain. I would think that if you came to visit, I would take you to, I do have a pet place where I can take people to kind of go, this is an example of how this manifests in the real world. There is one place to show people. And there's a place in Amsterdam, by the way, that's already on this, and it's called Upcycle. They call it Upcycle. Mm-hmm. And it's a similar idea. You know, it's belts made out of tires, human belts for clothing made out of tires, you know, things like that. It's well thought. It's old transistor radios refurbished to pieces of art that still work as transistor radios.
Whoa, cool.
You know, there's a lot of these ideas out there, but we have to think this way, and we need to have policy changes simultaneously, because we really do need this true cost. If we get true costs in goods, then recycling and reusing, refurbishing and maintaining will become much more normal, because things will be, every incremental thing will be more valuable that way, more economical that way.
Yep.
So I hope I made sense to your listening audience. And I really enjoyed talking to you guys. You've been very good.
Likewise.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you for your wealth of knowledge and for the literature leads that you've provided.
Yeah. And thank you for preparing these slides. And again, for those listening to the audio only, you can take a look to the show notes and we'll link to the video recording where you can see all the awesome graphics and visuals.
We're off here now. Are we off? Can we cut off now?
Not quite. We're just gonna wrap up. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
I think you know, Jamie Snyder, which is Bucky's grandson. Mm-hmm. He lives in California, and he'd be worth interviewing. I can send you his email address.
Yeah, that'd be great. We'd love to interview him.
He'd be worth interviewing. He's a really cool guy. He's very talented. His dad, by the way, did a documentary about Bucky and got an Academy Award, if I remember right.
Wow, really?
So, yeah. So
awesome. Thank you again. There's
a lot of good connections in the Bucky world. I'll send you some more, because there's a guy in San Diego doing some pretty interesting stuff around the World Game. It's still a viable way to look at the world. Bucky's idea was that if you just explain to pieces how resources were not distributed very, very equally, how the poorest 20% of the world was living was much worse than the poorest 20% of the United States, is part of his point at the time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, a lot of the Bucky stuff is worth bringing up back again, because he wasn't thinking so much in his time as he was thinking in his paradigm, which made him very special.
Absolutely. Definitely. Yeah.
He's definitely a personal hero.
It's good to talk to people that knew about him. It's really cool.
Yeah, we're big fans and glad that you could integrate and bring up some of his work in the modern context for what's going on right now.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you so much, and thank you everyone for listening. We'll be back next week, and hope you stay tuned, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you're enjoying it, and feel free to leave a review. It really helps us out. Have a wonderful rest of your week, and see you soon.